The track is on the one, the band, Van Halen. The album, Van Halen's 1978 self-titled debut, on lead guitar, none other than the one and only late great Eddie Van Halen. You are listening to Higher Ground with me, John Graff, and my colleagues Aaron N. with 2N, C. Larson, marketing and communication sorceress here at Hirsch Roberts Weinstein in Boston. And we are joined today by Scott Schneider, the Tom Petty of rock and roll from Austin, Texas, and our good friend Josh Nolan from Bricker and Eckler in Cleveland, Ohio. That's a big rock and roll spot, right, Josh? Cleveland.
Cleveland rocks, man.
Cleveland rocks. It's only appropriate since we are the only podcast focusing on higher education legal issues with a healthy or unhealthy, however you see it, dose of heavy metal and rock and roll discussion that we acknowledge the passing this week of Eddie Van Halen. Scott, can you play guitar like that?
No, but I am taking lessons right now, so I'm trying, but no, it's really bad. I do a really awesome twinkle twinkle on the high E string right now. I shred. You know the thing I like about that song? I mean, Eddie Van Halen is, like, as a rhythm guitarist, that's my thing with Eddie Van Halen is, he's a shredder, but his rhythm guitar is, like, just impeccable. The thing I like about that song, though, is the bass player. What's that guy's name?
Oh, Michael Anthony.
Michael Anthony, who, like, is kind of a, he's kind of a, you know, kind of goofy guy, you know? Mm-hmm. But his harmonies with Eddie Van Halen in that song are just, like, so awesome, man.
I think a lot of people fail to recognize the quality of the harmonies in all of Van Halen's music simply because they're overwhelmed by the guitar.
Yeah, yeah. And the drums. I mean, and Alex Van Halen is just, like, has this totally interesting sound. But, yeah, what a blow, man. It's, like, it's bad for Aaron, what were you doing in 1978?
I was in outer space waiting to get conceived.
She was in outer space wearing her Angel of Death t-shirt. No, so right. Before we came on, Aaron and I were talking, and she said, yeah, I should have gotten my Angel of Death t-shirt. And that was actually a reference to what, Aaron?
Alice in Chains from our last episode.
Because in the last episode, Scott was saying to Aaron, Josh, that he's going to try to school her up on some quality music, including Angel of Death. I mean, Alice in Chains.
Yeah.
I think we have to qualify what quality music means. Aaron, we need to broaden out your education from Scott, I think.
Well,
Alice in Chains is awesome. Alice in Chains is awesome. I'm not going to, you know, but let's keep that fine.
Well, we will indoctrinate her in Van Halen over the next week or so in between recordings. Yeah. So I appreciate you guys joining us today, carving out the time. I know you're busy. I will start today's discussion with disclosing a concern that I had when we first started this podcast was whether there would actually be enough to discuss to keep interest in a higher ed legal issues podcast, right? Because, I mean, it's the law. It's not the most exciting thing in the world at the end of the day. And then this year hit. That's the bell that says, yes, you're onto something, John. This year hit, right?
That's a new executive order from the Trump administration coming in right now.
There's so much. So, what I do to get ready for these shows is I comb the Chronicle of Higher Ed. I comb Inside Higher Ed. I comb the Times education section, Boston Globe education section. I've been able to just stop lately at the Chronicle because it's like everything is happening in the world right now. And then compounding everything is the passing of Eddie Van Halen. But we can just stop with the Chronicle. And so on October 1, I see an article that says, it's entitled, where is it? three universities face U.S. inquiries into free speech controversies. And then this leads into a discussion, of course, about Department of Ed investigations. And we're not really going to get too deep into that stuff. But as chance would have it, on October 2, I sit in on a webinar put on by Josh Nolan, Jeff Knight, and Jessica Galanos, entitled Free Speech on the College Campus, sponsored by Bricker and Eckler, friends of Hirsch Roberts Weinstein, of course, which, Josh, it was outstanding. Major kudos to you guys. Fantastic.
Thank you. It was fun to put on.
So this was actually the second webinar that I've attended that was put on by Bricker. The first one was a Title IX training that I needed to hit for some continuing ed requirements. And that was fantastic, man. Your co-presenter, Jessica Galanos, she was on the Title IX training, along with Aaron Butcher, I believe. And they were amazing. And so I'm listening to all of these webinars in the last couple of weeks, and I'm thinking, Brickler must screen people for their presentation ability before they hire them. Is that what's happening?
I wish that were the case. I wish we were that smart. We just pick really good folks.
Rock stars. Rock stars, everybody. So just a little bit of background on Josh, a person that I respect very much. He is widely respected in higher ed legal circles throughout the country. You're not ever going to find anyone who will ever say anything less than complimentary about Mr. Nolan. He is a legal scholar and a superior practitioner by any measure, a consummate professional and gentleman, a damn fine presenter, and just a good friend and good person. And that's why we are fortunate to have you here today. So thank you. Thank you.
I also say about Josh, Josh is probably on the down low the most interesting person in all of higher education. This dude's got some, I'm looking at his door. He's got this crazy house that he rehabilitated. Like, I tell a story about, you know, whatever concert I went to, and Josh is like, oh yeah, I was backstage with John Bon Jovi, man. He's really good. He's the most interesting dude in higher ed, man.
John Bon Jovi, who's now all about country, right?
Hell if I know, sure, man.
So, Josh, you're
That's on nice of you to say, Scott.
You're on Twitter, at Josh Nolan is the handle, and I've noticed a trend. So some decision will come out of a federal court, right? And that there tells you it's going to be a complicated decision, complicated law, complicated facts. And they typically analyze a web of things, issues that are related to something very, very intricate. And I've noticed that as soon as the decision is out, Nolan is on Twitter breaking it down in almost real time. How do you do that so quickly?
You know, I have to give credit to my colleague, Melissa Carlton, who is somehow hardwired into the internet, because she becomes instantly aware of these things that happen. So she is kind of behind the scenes saying, hey, who within our group is going to break down this case or this issue? So there is some intentionality to it. But I must say, I feel like I have to get it out ahead because of the smart people that I work with. So a lot of it is just trying to stay afloat.
See, like I said, just totally nice person, right? Give all the credit to the team, which is a good thing to do. Melissa's a great lawyer, great friend also. I'm glad you mentioned her.
But I think lurking behind that selfless exterior is an enormous ego of Josh Nolan. at least that's what I've heard from talking to everybody at the firm. Guy is very high maintenance, man.
You have to have a big ego to use the old school earbuds with the wire on them and everything. Well,
it's just, I'm cheap. I'm just cheap.
Well, you've spent all that money on the door behind you. It's great to have you guys with us. I think it's probably appropriate to have a little bit of talk here on Higher Ground about free speech issues as we head into what is going to be a very complicated election season. It is already complicated if you've seen any of the debates. These investigations that the Department of Ed has initiated, have you guys recalled seeing anything like this in the history of higher ed?
Ooh, man, what a good question. The parallel, and it was obviously very different, was, I mean, I never saw anything like what the Obama administration did around Title IX during the previous administration. So, I mean, that was really new and different. My hunch is like in the 80s, there were some culture war oriented OCR complaints around like things like dropping wrestling programs and stuff like that. But yeah, so it feels like, you know, with every administration change, you know, the pendulum kind of swings back and forth. The thing I always think is super interesting, and I'm kind of curious about you all on this. Like, I've seen an uptick in some Title IX related investigations around scholarships. I have a couple around race issues, but it's like, there's this initial, hey, we're going to send out the request for information and get all this information. And then like, it drags on for years and nothing really happens. I still have open investigations from the Obama administration. It's like they have this enormous appetite, but they don't have the resources to really process these complaints and investigations in prompt ways. I'm kind of curious if you all are seeing the same thing, or it's like they go for this big, you know, sort of, I want to do something that gets us on the front page of the Chronicle, but the actual heavy lifting of doing the work just seems to trail off a little bit.
Josh, what do you think? Is this a political play to mobilize a conservative element, you know, through a headline? Is that really what this is about?
You know, it's an interesting question. There's part of me that believes that this is, you know, when you look at the cluster of investigations, and particularly the timing of the final rule that came out regarding, you know, free inquiry and religious liberty, it sort of dovetails into this idea of, hey, and you saw this with the 2011 Dear Colleague letter, right? Sort of concurrently with Vice President Biden at the time making the announcement in New Hampshire about the sort of the Dear Colleague letter, you had a series of investigations that came out there around Title IX and sexual misconduct specifically. Here you've got a cluster of sort of free speech investigations that pop up and have a lot of, I think, eye-catching facts to them. And they're, again, in line with another set of regulations that are coming out. So it's one way to alert, I think, the public that this is of interest. It's certainly driving the narrative and the news coverage recently, and the timing from the election, I think, has to be connected back to sort of, you know, value signaling for the administration.
Yeah, it's like higher ed is sort of put up as this, it's like we're right in the middle of the culture wars, and, you know, you find conservative folks come up with this sort of caricature of, like, you know, you mentioned like spicy facts. Whenever I'm involved in one of those cases and you read the press clippings about it and all that sort of stuff, there's a real attractive press story. And then you get into the weeds a little bit and it's like, wow, this is not, so much more nuance here. You kind of open it up a little bit. And you're like, this is sort of a boring case, but then the narrative is already out there. And the narrative is, like, higher education is, you know, just this aloof, very liberal, out of touch enterprise. And we, as, you know, whatever, are going to come in and, you know, make a political case of this. And I see that. I mean, it happening on those free speech. You see that. I know at some point we'll probably talk about this. You know, just yesterday, I think the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against Yale connected to their undergrad admissions. The Title IX regulations are a form of that. I mean, what Betsy DeVos, you know, and what the popular narrative is around, you know, what was the motivation for the regs? I mean, it was kind of taking bits and pieces on Twitter that if you actually did a more thorough assessment of what was going on in those cases, the approach was a lot more reasonable than what was being made out. But yeah, we're right in the middle of you know, the political crossfire. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's the response to the indoctrination theory, right? Perception that higher ed is so far to the left and that it is indoctrinating young students. And so something to try to anchor what it perceives, or what the Department of Ed perceives as a pendulum swing far to the left, back to the right. Who knows, does this actually That's actually the Department of Ed calling me right now. I'm not even joking. I'm not even kidding. We're not going to put the video up. So
they're listening right now, man.
It is literally Department of Ed. But anyway, interesting also, because now we've got an executive order that talks about what federal contractors can't talk about in their diversity and inclusion trainings, right? And so we've got free speech enforcement, free speech zone enforcement, really, was what it boils down to, I think. We've got restrictions on what the diversity and inclusion content can look like. And now, in reference to Scott's point, I've got in front of me Inside Higher Ed's article titled "The Justice Department Sues Yale," posted today, October 9, and it reads as follows. The Justice Department sued Yale University, claiming the university discriminates against Asian Americans and white applicants if it did not change its admissions practices. Yale maintains that its admissions practices are legal and protected by Supreme Court precedent. What's going to happen with this one?
Well, I mean, I'll start off, you know, because I get this question, it feels like every couple of months. I mean, there seems to be a push to yet again get the Supreme Court to weigh in on the use of race in admissions programs at universities. And so we're, you know, Yale is, you know, part of that. We're seeing kind of agenda-oriented groups suing University of Texas here in Austin, University of North Carolina, I mean, all Harvard as well. But I think everybody's angling for the Supreme Court to take another look at this issue. And I said this morning, it's so weird because I had a call with a really smart general counsel this morning. We were sort of kicking around some of these issues, but I'm maybe in a small minority here. I don't see the court. I can't imagine the court touching this one again. I mean, think about this. It's such a narrow issue. Under racial preferences in undergraduate admissions at a university. And at this point, the Supreme Court in 40 years has looked at this issue 5 times. Why would they take it up again? I mean, and every time the court gets mired in this, and you go back to Bakke, you go back to the University of Texas cases, it's like it almost feels as if the court goes, wow, I'm sorry we got involved in this, because undergraduate admissions processes and the issues around that, including autonomy for higher education institutions, those are complicated issues. And do you want a Supreme Court justice weighing in on, or a Supreme Court trying to set the rules around these issues? So, I mean, I think there's a big push for putting up a case that the Supreme Court will take a look at this again and maybe come in and say you could never use race. I think that's what people are angling for, but I think they're going to be sorely disappointed. Now, I will say this, and I'm kind of interested in, I'm definitely interested in Josh's opinion on this. I mean, there's people talk about the holdings in the University of Texas cases as saying, they say you can use race. Well, yes and no. I mean, it's a very narrow use of race that if you're going right. to use it, you're opening yourself up to some degree of litigation challenge because the parameters are just so narrow.
Right.
But I would, you know, the movement from really Fisher 1 and 2 finally set some standards and removed deference from college universities about their admission standards. And so I think what you run into is finally some articulated structure that a court will then apply to see whether or not college universities are looking at data sets and what their population is currently and what their targets are and how and what their procedures are for analyzing the impacts of non-discriminatory programs. And I think that is the farthest that they've gone. I agree with you, Scott. I don't think the Supreme Court is going to take on a case that would provide any more guidance than what you see in the two Fisher cases. And nor should they. I mean, I think there's been an erosion of sort of court's deference to educational institutions and their ability to manage who is a student and what the educational process is. And I think one of the through lines through all of this regulation that we're seeing currently, and really for the last 6 years, has been that idea of what amount of institutional autonomy do we have? And I would say that one area that we've seen some shift is really in religious-based institutions as well, right? Mm-hmm. So part of that final rule deals with the ways in which the department can define and institutions can define when they become religiously controlled for the purposes of being exempted from some of the Title IX requirements. And so we have this sort of preference to religious-based institutions in terms of their operations. But to me, it's fascinating to figure out where, and I always go back to, so before I went to law school, I was a student affairs administrator. So I can't get rid of that lens in terms of when I read these fact patterns, I'm like having flashbacks to situations on campus where it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you know that you're dealing with a complicated situation and someone years later is going to criticize how you were doing things in the moment when a crisis breaks out. And so when I look at sort of, I like more guidance. I like the Fisher cases for that reason. But there's so much complexity now to what's going on. It's really difficult to say that one human being can hold all these concepts in their mind and deal with a crisis at the same time. So.
And it's like one of these great kind of, and the reason I think it comes out, why now? Like, we're what, two, three, how many more weeks do we have until this election? Please just get me to the election.
We're a month out.
It's the sort of narrative, man. It's like, really, I need to be careful about getting too political, but, this concern about, universities running roughshod, and we see this, by the way, in the executive order, siding with one wing of an ideological agenda against white guys, it's really what it is. If we cut to it a little bit, and that's, this Yale lawsuit is in that vein. And I think it's, the design here is to kind of, play to that base. There's a political motivation for that.
So to your point, Scott, to your point about the Supreme Court not hearing a case like this again, that was my first thought. We look at the timing of the executive order, and I'm not taking a political position on any of this. I'm fascinated by political strategy, no matter what side it's on. We look at the timing of the executive order on the diversity trainings. We look at the free speech investigations, and we look at now the admissions challenge that specifically speaks to white and Asian American components of the population. And so what other message are we supposed to take from that other than there's a push to mobilize a vote here?
Yeah, and it was so funny. I was watching, I don't know if y'all watched the vice presidential debate. Did you hear there was a fly? Did you hear about this?
Yeah. The fly was like big news actually the next day.
The fly was...
I was just going to say, the fly has its own Twitter account now.
It's got 16,000 followers. It had 14,000 followers in 90 seconds. Like, that's huge.
It was so weird.
Are you serious? It has lots of followers, huh?
Oh, yeah. I followed it instantaneously.
I have a moment about the fly. Pence's hair is so gray. And it just sat there for a while. Like typically a fly would hit it and move, but it was like ensnared in the hair. It was kind of,
it's so funny. I'm sitting there on the couch watching this, staying up late, right? Because this is our business and we got to know what's happening in the law and with the politics and everything. I look at the fly and I say, holy this is unfortunate.
But the thing I got sidetracked by the fly. Mike Pence is sitting here going, and this is kind of standard fare for Republicans. We want to cut bureaucracy. We want to reduce regulations. And I go, dude, the one industry I know something about, nothing could be further from the truth.
Right.
I mean, on a, on a daily basis, I wait for, is there going to be a new executive order or some new potential regulations? You think of like even the Title IX regulations, and you know, we've sort of almost moved past that at this point. It's like it was a big deal. We haven't had
Title
new regs, right. Since 1975. And you go, I think I've said this here before. Like if you were to go to the general industry, like a Walmart, or I have a Whole Foods by my house, and say anytime one of your employees is accused of sex harassment, we're going to issue, you have to follow these regulations, which talk about all these notice requirements. And oh, by the way, cobble together a hearing at Whole Foods with lawyers representing both of the employees. That sort of regulation applied to any industry other than higher education would be greeted with, like, I can't even imagine what Fox News would be saying about that or the litigation associated with it. It's insane. Yeah.
Do you think that that's because the federal government actually controls the purse strings to so much of what happens in higher ed?
Well, I think they have more say so over higher ed because of that, but I think higher ed is a politically attractive pinata. I mean, it's good to continue to, you know, it's representative of like kind of airhead liberals and all this sort of stuff. And so keep going after them. I think that's really what this is about. Josh, I'm kind of curious. I mean,
I think for me, it's the idea of complexity, particularly the regulatory and what's hard for me is trying to keep track of, you know, not only sort of these new free speech regulations and we're now in this sort of implementation phase of Title IX. You know, it's working out all of the kinks from sort of the esoteric, you know, black and white regulations to now like what does it mean when a student makes a report and how do we kind of shepherd that case through on a college campus? And sort of the spaces that were not anticipated by the regulations, although we have to strictly comply with them, is fascinating to me. The overlay with, then you've got state orders about COVID and you've got CDC guidance. And again, I go back to like, how is it possible for one human being or a set of human beings to keep track of all of these things? And then operate a business who is facing existential crises in terms of tuition, risk management, keeping people in residence halls, even in a de-densified sort of way. It's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing. You talk to folks on campus, you call them, and typically there's some pleasantries that are exchanged, and then people just start to laugh nervously because it's just overwhelming to them. And I feel like, particularly, and I don't know how your practices are, but we've been full out since March. To a blistering degree. And I think it's reflected in the complexity that institutions are trying to deal with. And it's hard to even do the fundamentals under those circumstances.
It is tough. It's tough. When you get on that call, Josh, and you hear that laughter right off the bat, as a former student, you were in student affairs, right?
Correct.
What was your job back in the day?
So I worked in residence life, and then I was the conduct officer. So I worked in the dean of students office at a small residential college, northwestern Pennsylvania.
So we have this in common. You are the only person that I know who has a similar career track. I was, right after I served as a police officer, I was the associate director of a student conduct office at a large university.
Josh and John are basically the like the narcs of higher ed. I think that's
narcs. It's a great movie, Ray Liotta, Jason Patrick.
Yeah. You guys like people are trying to have some fun, and you just come in and crack down on them, right?
Yeah, no weed, no booze, no fun.
Kids are trying to run with the devil, and you're just in there going, no, no, no.
Yeah, that's right.
My favorite, the student newspaper, one of the opinion pages, I think my favorite moniker was General in the War Against Fun, which was awesome. I remember I knew the student that wrote the opinion piece. I'm like, that's awesome. I'm going to get a t-shirt made. Like General in the War Against Fun. It'd be perfect.
Did you live? Did you live with the students, like in housing?
I did. So I lived on a college campus for 16 years. Aaron's face. Thank God it's a podcast because typically that's the face that happens. Yeah. From 1993 to 2009, I lived in college housing. And wow. So I was, as I like to say, you're just surrounded by chaos all the time in a great way, right? Like students figure themselves out and they're living together and they're having a good time. And if you're a student development person, like that was my graduate degree, was in higher ed. It was awesome. It was great to just kind of watch the laboratory happen around you. And you were never, the work was never boring. And it was always fulfilling. I met my wife there working there too. She was the director of Greek life and the director of student activities. And I was like, hey, you know, we should move back on campus. That would be great. And she's like, no, we can't. None of us. My two kids would love it. They would love it. They'd be rock stars on campus, but I can't quite get the wife to do that.
Do you have calls now? This has been my experience. I won't say every, but most of the calls I have, especially with student affairs professionals, who I think all of us share this kind of love for that part of the law and the people that do that work, the burnout is off the charts, man.
It's a high rate. It's a high rate.
Yeah.
Like, I've yet to talk to someone. I've yet to talk to some, like, I feel like every time I pick up the phone and talk to one of those folks, it's like almost a therapy session. They're so burned out, man.
I think the only field of professional in higher ed that has a higher burnout rate than student affairs is probably Title IX.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The coordinator function.
And I would say Title IX coordinators are kind of at the pinnacle of that. And part of it, they're in impossible roles, right? Like you're even if you run a perfect process, the outcome is going to create, you know, a lot of controversy regardless of the way it goes. And they're subject to that. And I think what I worry about is where do people find the joy in their work, right? For attorneys, oftentimes it's like, let me help you fix this problem, or let's get really creative. And let me be do a deep dive and become an expert in a certain subject to help you apply that to your college campus. And with student affairs professionals, it's the love of the student interaction. You know, it's that. And when it's constantly adversarial, or when you feel like you're sort of the tipping point between really effectuating some educational change, but feeling that you're being bogged down by process and things in which like take away some of the joy of that job, I think it's really hard. And what I don't see is where's that relief valve, right? Like, we're creating structures that we're just churning through people every couple of years because they've got to move to a new place to reset. And that to me is really it's an unhealthy place to be.
Well, anytime anybody has fun, Josh Nolan comes in there and says, you can't have it.
Cause you get a letter of warning.
Right.
Exactly. He's the GWAF.
That's right.
He's the GWAF, the general in the war against
fun. Housing probation. Housing probation, right? But it's true, though.
Exactly.
You know, in a student affairs capacity, in a lot of positions, you have an opportunity to make a meaningful contribution to somebody's development. And I actually enjoyed that about the student conduct role. I mean, I have people who stay in touch with me to this day, people who I had sanctioned, but had come to me afterwards and said, this was a great learning experience for me. I'm going to share a story that I have not shared with anybody, really. We had a young man one time who was an ROTC student, and the school I was working at had a pretty strict policy on alcohol in the residence halls. Like, if you had over a certain quantity, you were out, you'd lose your housing. And this required, this kid gets in trouble. He's got over the quantity, and so he's out of housing, but this would have triggered a loss of an ROTC scholarship. And so without the on-campus housing, you're not eligible for the scholarship. And so that would be that. This kid's father was a colonel or a retired colonel in the Army. And so, this is a big, big moment for this family. And it's one of those situations. So I was hearing the appeal on the case, And it's one of those situations where you think, man, this is a really tough call, right? Because policy's got to be applied consistently, but it's also got to be applied equitably. And the sanction, the ultimate sanction for a student like this is greater than it is for a student who may not be in the ROTC program. Now, some would say, well, hey, look, that's just what you sign up for when you're in ROTC. But it didn't feel like the right outcome to me. So I overturned the sanction. Never heard from this kid again. He goes on to graduate. When I'm at my first law firm in Worcester, Mass, right out of law school, I get a call out of the blue from the kid's father. He was a colonel. And he says to me, Mr. Graff, I want to thank you for what you did for my son, you know, like 5-6 years ago. He says he just got back from Afghanistan, where he had a 1-year deployment. He was an infantry lieutenant, a ranger. He said he led all of those troops back. Not one of them got killed or injured. Wow, and man. So I'm thinking back like, geez, this one moment in this kid's life had the potential to affect the health and life and safety of 40 people in his platoon several years later in a war in the Middle East. You know, so it can be a very rewarding experience to interact with the students. You don't have that in the Title IX function. You only exist because there's sexual assault, right?
Yeah, look, that's an interesting, so I've been doing, I'm blessed to work with one of my colleagues, Paige Duggins Clay, and we've gotten really on this restorative justice bandwagon. I think it's something, it's finally something I'm super in the world of higher education, super optimistic and excited about. But yeah, you forget. So I have a theory, which is, and it's funny that we're doing this podcast and you go, John goes, there's an endless amount of material. I'm like, there are too many lawyers in higher education. We have an oversized role in higher education that I don't think is healthy at this point. And part of what you said a second ago, it's like, you know, I almost think we need to expect 18 to 21 year olds to make mistakes in that setting in a way that doesn't forever change the trajectory of their lives in a negative way. And look, there's some things you just can't do. And if you do them, you're done. But part of the beauty of higher education is creating a space where someone can make a mistake. They acknowledge they've made a mistake and that maybe they've hurt someone. They fix it. That's the educational component, and they become productive citizens. And there's a part of me, and maybe I'm being too harsh about lawyers, that I feel like the involvement in lawyers or over-involvement of lawyers and concerns about risk management and all that sort of stuff have sort of trumped those considerations. It's almost easier sometimes from a risk management perspective to say, separate the kid right. from the institution, and you lose track of that. And it's, that's a great anecdote, John.
Yeah, but I think you're right, Scott. You know, the world, it's not just higher ed, right? There's risk assessment, there's risk mitigation, there's risk concern everywhere you go. You can't take your kid to go bowling or to go, you know, jump on the trampoline. I guess I understand why, you know, you got the trampoline and the, you know, the jumping and the neck injuries, but every time I take my kids to a birthday party, or when I used to take them pre-COVID, I have to sign a release for something.
Well, you know what we need to do? We need to start a Van Halen inspired like risk management consulting company. And like the tagline will be like, I live my life like there's no tomorrow. That's a great way to go, man. Except there is. Have you seen David Lee Roth lately? Like when I was a kid, Jesus, David Lee Roth was this beautiful guy, right? It was like, that's what I want to aspire to be like. And he lived his life like there was no tomorrow. And here we are 30 years later, and he looks really bad.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a theory that partying and lots of drugs and, you know, not sleeping kind of burns you out a little bit.
Is that a theory? Is that from the GWAF? The general in the war against fun, is that what he says?
That's what the general says. That was part of the speech that I gave to every kid. You know, you will burn out and look like David Lee Roth if you continue on this path.
I must say, if there's any benefit to COVID, the hairstyles have returned back to, you know, the Panama video. Big, unkept masses of hair. I am glad that the pants didn't come back, but the hair is there.
Do you find it weird? So I look, this is, we're going off on a little tangent, but this is what makes this fun. Do you look at the old, like, Van Halen videos, and I'm talking about that Panama era, Running with the Devil era, and go, wow, yeah, it's so weird to see so much body hair on David Lee Roth.
Yeah, the body hair, like a commercial for a waxing company. Wait for it. I love David Lee Roth.
Do you all love David Lee Roth? Like, I have moments where you can't think of Van Halen. So we're going to riff on Van Halen for a little while.
Let's do it.
Without David Lee Roth, right? I mean, it's like part of the lore, yeah, in the 80s of David Lee, of Van Halen, is the videos and David Lee Roth. I find his vocals to be one of the most annoying things in the world. Like the one we were just talking about, Running with the Devil. That should be an awesome song that he almost ruins single-handedly with his goofy vocals, man. He drives me crazy.
That's true. That said, I'm not sure many people could have pulled off a song like Ain't Talking About Love.
That's a fair point. Now, are you a Sammy Hagar, yeah, guy or a David Lee Roth guy?
Me? I'm a David Lee Roth guy. I mean, Sammy Hagar's got a great voice, great stage presence, but I could just never get into him, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, except for I Can't Drive 55. I mean, of course.
Again, from a risk management perspective, very, very scary.
All of it.
We need to do a presentation on Van Halen songs where we just talk. This is me. I'm now like 48 years old and I'm fully a lawyer.
All the risk management
concerns with everything that Van Halen is talking about here. I think that's going to be my webinar idea. Do you think Bricker would let me do that with your team of amazing presenters?
Without question.
Risk management through the eyes of David Lee Roth. Mm-hmm.
Did you have, I guarantee you, by the way, the Panama video, the pants that David Lee Roth is wearing, I guarantee you John Graff has worn some version of those pants.
Negativo. No, that wouldn't bode well with our VH consulting strategies, risk management consulting firm. So just because you had to go here. So I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, a guy named Robert, and there you go, Robert. I mentioned you on the podcast. He was asking me if we were going to talk about Falwell today. And then Scott said, and I have to go back to my notes here first because I'm a lawyer, so I take notes. He said something about spicy facts. And then where was it? Oh, somebody said something about religious institutions. So spicy facts and religious institutions, that was Mr. Nolan. That leads us to one, Jerry Falwell. Discuss.
Man, what a weird, I love this story. I can't, Aaron is putting her head down. I gotta be honest with you. I can't get enough of this story. I want more facts.
I don't think you do. I don't think you do. We were talking about doors before because Mr. Nolan has a nice door in his Victorian house behind him. That's sort of a feature of this whole story that just blows my mind is that, you know, there's this allegation that Mr. Falwell was hiding behind a door in his bedroom. Watching, it wasn't the gardener. I think it was like the pool boy. I see Falwell in there.
But there's a pool. This is the other part of the story I love. There's a pool boy.
It is. So last time I think I said it was like a Lifetime movie. It's not even like a Lifetime movie. It's like a John Cusack movie from the 1980s.
No, it's like even worse than that, man. He's such a goof, and my thing about it is...
You could play him in the movie, so, Scott.
No, I can't. Trust me. No, I can't. My thing about it is he portrays himself as this uber-masculine tough guy, and he's literally in a closet. I'm not going to say the rest. It is too much for my brain to handle.
I am super curious. Back to the academic for a second.
Yeah, and it's like there's this thing about it that it's just such a great story. Because look, I don't give whatever people do in their personal sexual lives, far be it from me to judge them. Yet, this guy has sort of made a living doing precisely that. It's just such a great story. Josh, what do you think about this one, man? I want to ensnare you.
I will say, I think I listened to the prior podcast and the two of you like riffing on this one. And I agree. The one adage that I think that is true about all of higher ed is that you can't make it up.
So true.
And it's not like you get into this situation where you're trying to one-up people and their fact patterns. But quite literally, I know of no other area of the law where people come to you and be like, hey, what are you working on now? Right? Like, tell us a fun story about what you're dealing with now. You know, it's like tax attorneys are pulling themselves out of the IRS code. And they're like, let's go talk to Scott and see what Scott's dealing with.
I found an extra penny.
At least entertaining.
Yeah. Right.
I gotta open a new file on the president's cuckolding scandal.
It's so true, though. It's so true because you look at it, right? Higher ed is an environment that just lends itself to all kinds of personalities coming together at the same place. Now, you could say that for any employer, but not when you're mixing with 18 to 22-year-olds, not when, you know, you're in an environment that, you know, I was going to say heretofore, but actually still is all about creativity and exploration and learning about yourself and other people and whatnot. Yeah. You get some really wacky ones.
This crap does not happen at Walmart or Whole Foods. It just does not. That's the only, like, I find this job, like, super, especially right now, super stressful. But that's the allure. It is, like, never boring, man. The issues are never boring. Like, there are days, I just got roped into a piece of commercial litigation just because I was like, I need a break from the intensity of emotions connected with higher ed. I'm like, yeah, I'll take this contract dispute. And so I'm going to litigate a commercial litigation thing just to get a break from higher ed, man.
Right, right. Yeah. No, but I mean, it is the kind of thing. So, you know, in college, we expect to hear that a young guy was standing up on the roof of a building on his dorm, lighting beer cans on fire and throwing them out into the street. We expect that because that happens in college. The wild card is, oh yeah, Professor so-and-so was up there doing it with him. Okay.
Nice.
Right? Now we got ourselves a little scandal. So there you have it, my friend Robert, the Falwell discussion. So let me bring it back to free speech for a second, because
in fact, before you do that, can we just do like a
Snyder's
series
free speeching all over the place?
A series of podcasts on nothing but this case, like maybe 10 of them,
yes.
An hour apiece.
Let's do it, man.
For it'll sure. Be called Inside the Closet with John Graff and Scott Snyder.
But I want it to be in the format of Serial. Right, like very serious.
Yes.
Very serious. Very serious.
The episode. I can't even control my laughter.
Breathless.
Episode one will be the pool boy. Episode two will be.
I can't. This is so terrible.
Aaron's like gonna fall on the floor. So I'm going to try now. I'm going to try to anchor it back towards the original topic of the day. Josh, what happens, do you think? Josh is like, whatever, dude. Whatever. We're on to Burt Reynolds. I don't care. What do you think is going to happen with these investigations? these free speech investigations?
I do think if you look at the particularly the letters from the Department of Education and the types of what they're really doing is they're linking it back to the misrepresentation regulations under Title IV. Mm-hmm. Right? So this idea, it's not only the free speech components of it, but it's saying, hey, if you put out into the ether through your policies or your handbook or your website that you are going to adhere to free speech principles and you fail to do that, that's going to be a form of, you know, consumer fraud, basically.
Right.
So when you look at the letters in terms of the types of questions and the types of documents they refer to set their case up, like the foundation of the investigation, it really informs the ways in which particularly private institutions, you look at this new final regulation about free speech, and it really links into what are your free speech and academic freedom policies. And I'll use the like policies in quotes because they're pulling things from your mission statement, your student handbook, your protest policy, the gamut of any published handbook that you have on campus that sort of, you know, tangentially references freedom of speech issues. And that's going to get wrapped into the ways in which the private schools particularly will be judged mm-hmm. to whether or not they're hitting those requirements. Right. And I think that's a dangerous place to be, particularly because very few schools have really scoped out, you know, where do these sort of ideas of free speech live on their campus in terms of their handbooks? And that can create situations that create a lot of litigation. And the other part is this idea of, you know, the only way in which you can be found in violation of the regulation is if you have this, you know, court finding, state or federal court finding, that you violated your policy, that you could then lose the availability of federal grant funding. And that's going to be a big hammer on sort of settling litigation cases in this context. If this final rule were to become effective and, you know, maintain after the election.
That's great analysis. Thank you. Yeah. Scott, you're going
to
say?
I just think it'll be interesting to see, and I don't know how the election will turn out, but if, you know, we get a new administration, if the proxy for this is going to be in litigation. You know, you start seeing more ideologically oriented litigation against higher ed institutions, aggressive breach of contract. I think of that Wisconsin lawsuit, you know, involving Marquette, which was basically just a boring breach of contract, you know, that becomes a free speech lawsuit. I'm wondering if we're going to see more of that. Also, it was interesting when the Princeton, I don't think we've talked about this one, we get that letter from the Department of Education from Princeton saying, oh, you've said all these things about your racist institution. Aha, now we're going to rope you into an investigation. I remember seeing, I can't remember who it was. It was like some president of a university saying, I acknowledge, you know, our racism. And I go, wow, I can see an enterprising attorney taking full advantage of that. In the context of litigation. And I would imagine that it'll be interesting to see if that becomes a trend. I can't foresee a situation where it doesn't.
Well, I saw that, right? I think it was the Princeton, the acknowledgement that triggered that Department of Ed review. And then I think a number of college presidents have signed off in support of Princeton's position in all of this. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes for sure. You know, in one of the earlier episodes, I think like first or second episode, we had Eric Kelderman on from the Chronicle of Higher Ed, and we were talking about free speech issues. And at the time, we were trying to give the listeners some takeaways. And one of the things that we discussed was the need to go back and look at your free speech policies now, or your speech policies, I should say, and start to plan for a speech-related event. Protest, really, you know, or some kind of confrontation, conflict, because, right, the worst time to plan for a crisis is when it hits. And though most free speech issues on college campuses never see publicity, right, these things happen, they're managed by the dean of students, the provost, the president, whatever, and all's well that ends well. But some of them do hit. They hit in the media, they hit in the courts, and you don't have the ability to choose what type of event you get. You could have the little one or the big one. And then if you're not prepared for it, then you're on your heels the whole time. you're playing defense, and that's never a good place to be. So one of the things we had suggested to people in the past was, you know, look at your policies, make sure you understand what those policies mean, make sure that the policies actually reflect the current values of the institution, right? How many times with higher ed do we hear, oh, that's not how we do it, but then we see the policy and we say, well, the policy says you do it this way, and that's the standard that you held to in litigation and in before the Department of Education.
Yeah, and I never, I'm going to put this out there now. I never agree with Eric Kelderman about anything. And I don't like his, I don't like his attitude either. He's guy's got a lot of attitude. But Eric is one of my favorite people.
For sure.
He's really smart, but this is the first time I've ever agreed with Eric Kelderman on anything. So mark that in the show notes, Aaron.
So we'll ask him to come back on and you guys can riff about free speech, and Josh and I will riff about something else, and Aaron will join us. So
yeah, and look, and these things play themselves out. And I know, you know, it's a high profile case, and it'll be interesting to see how it, you know, works its way through the appellate courts. But like that Oberlin verdict, for instance, I mean, the way in which, I mean, here we have students engaged in, you know, in essence, protected speech, and it boomerangs back on the university in the form of a defamation lawsuit that leads. I mean, the permutations on this are really fascinating and interesting.
Any final thoughts, either one of you, on free speech, diversity, inclusion, executive orders, Yale admissions, Jerry Falwell?
I think we got Falwell pretty much well papered on this one. I would.
That's what you think.
ten episode podcast coming up.
Spin-off.
I would say, you know, take a look at the Princeton sort of the initiatives that they were putting together. It's not just the statement from the president, but underneath that, these are likely would be standard things that you would do to just manage admissions, to deal with employment trends on campus. Like, they're not controversial at all.
Right.
If you look at it from the perspective of what are the ways in which an institution would address, you know, the current climate on campus, you would do all of these things. It's a very rational approach. But the sort of this overview, this gloss of, hey, we have, we're impacted by systemic racism, and we're taking steps to deal with it, is being used against them, unfortunately. But even if you were to take the context of the Department of Education letter out, and you were to look at like a, you know, a resolution agreement 10 or 15 years ago, you'd probably see some of these same sort of requirements. You know, you need to look at what are your employment practices and what's your data set, and does your workforce reflect the diversity of your students and your community, right? Like, these are really basic things.
And there are also things that the Department of Ed oftentimes doesn't tell you you're doing it wrong. They just say, you got to look at your policies, right?
Correct.
Great thoughts. Scott, closing thoughts? Or do we even want to go there?
No, I mean, I'm happy to go there. Look, I think my closing thought is listen to the Van Halen, the first album. Holy moly. And like, think of it from the perspective. No, I mean, seriously, think of it from the perspective that you're putting it on. It's 1982. Is that when did that record come out?
It's like 78.
Okay.
I was four years old at the time. Great year.
I mean, it's like, it's just like impeccable art, which I'm a big fan of, but listen to that one from like start to finish. If you've never been into, like, if you don't understand, like, why people are reacting to Eddie Van Halen, I mean, golly, I mean, it's just impeccable, both the kind of soloing work he's doing, but God, just the rhythm guitar stuff, man, is impeccable and awesome. That's my final thought for the day. I see DJ John Graff.
Baby, all about your disease.
Josh Nolan, thank you for joining us. You're on Twitter a lot. How can our listeners find you?
You can find me at Josh D. Nolan on Twitter. JNolan@Bricker.com on my email.
Outstanding.
By the way, don't confuse Josh D. Nolan with Josh R. Nolan. That guy is out of control. Josh D. Nolan.
Scott, how do our listeners find you, my man?
Just
text him.
No, I'll do Twitter again for a little while.
You back on the tweeter?
A little bit. Ed Law Dude. I'm Ed Law Dude.
Ed Law Dude. Okay. Aaron, how do our listeners find us?
Well, I am excited to share that our very own podcast has its very own Twitter. So please find us at HRW Higher Ground.
Outstanding. And what platforms are we on as of today?
Well, Twitter is our bread and butter, but that could change.
Yeah. And you can find us on Buzzsprout.
Yes.
Buds, what a day.
Buzzsprout. Can we do TikTok?
Apple Podcast. TikTok. No, I'm not going to be TikToking today. No, I can't do that. Scott, Josh, thank you very much for sharing your insights. It's always great to connect with you guys. Really appreciate you being here. My name is John Graff. I'm a partner at Hirsch Roberts Weinstein in Boston. You can find me at JT Graff on Twitter, or you can hit me at jgraff@hrwlawyers.com. We're on LinkedIn. We're on the internet. If you like what you heard today, please consider sharing us. The word is out. Our numbers are solid, and they are getting better by the week. We thank you all for that. That's a wrap.